For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook and visit arsenalfordemocracy.com to read the articles referenced in this episode. This is Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island, from the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 295, recorded on February 9th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me, as always, on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line here in Massachusetts is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be here.
So we're going to talk this week a little bit about the Iowa caucuses, but more importantly, about overall changes to the Democratic Party primary calendar and nomination process rules that have happened since 2016, so that people have a better understanding contextually of what is going to be coming down the pipeline, depending on how things shake out in the next couple of weeks and next few months. Let's start off by talking, at least in brief, about what kind of fiasco happened with the Iowa caucuses. A lot of that reflected some of the changes and then a weird way of implementing those changes since 2016 and previous years. But more importantly, states like Idaho, where Rachel is, that had caucuses no longer have caucuses in many cases. So we're going to talk about that kind of thing as well. Rachel, let's start out by talking about Iowa. There were some significant changes that happened from 2016 to this year that affected things, probably, I would argue, in a positive direction for the most part, but then kind of and by all accounts, everything that I've heard was that the actual conduct of the caucuses themselves on the ground was quite smooth and often less contentious than in past years, but that the ultimate relaying of those results and the, you know, conclusions that the media would be drawing from them was kind of bungled. So what do we need to know about how the Iowa caucuses were run this year and what happened?
Well, I think we were all kind of expecting an almost like instantaneous release of results that kind of has happened in years past. So I think a lot of us were sitting there twiddling our thumbs, watching the news anxiously, refreshing websites, just trying to figure out what was going on. And then we kind of had to sit back and wait because there were data quality control checks happening. And
yeah, I think that was a little startling when they decided the word choice they were going to use specifically, right, instead of just explaining that there was a problem with their app, was to say that they were doing quality control on the results, which sounds like a euphemism for rigging an election. And they were more willing to say that than to admit that they had made a mistake with their app vendor.
Right. So there was a new app kind of ominously developed by the weirdly named Shadow company. And I think the app just totally broke down in the data transmission, right? I think it tabulated the scores okay, but there just was a breakdown in communicating those scores to the Democratic Party, the state party.
And apparently a lot of people hadn't downloaded it in time and didn't realize that they were going to need to have downloaded it more than the day of and get an account and everything, which I don't know what, but anyway.
Another thing I heard that was an issue was that it was like basically on the beta testing, like they hadn't like fully tested it. So if like more than two people logged on at once, then it would start crashing or not input the data fully.
Yeah, it's what happens when you have the learn to code Democrats who literally just learned to code trying to run gigantic platforms like this and have no concept of what it takes to actually do this.
Right. So it was just poorly vetted, poorly implemented. And I think the training rollout just didn't happen really well either. So I think a lot of caucus organizers were left scrambling, calling in their numbers to the state party, just kind of figuring out how to get those numbers to the state party. Also, it was a very convoluted process. There was a lot of rounding happening because the caucuses were choosing state delegate equivalents. So it's
which is also new this year compared to in the past years when they would literally be choosing delegates for things. I mean, in the past, I think it was that there was this thing, okay, first we have, you know, each caucus site is sending delegates to a county convention later in the process. And then at the very end of the process, usually like May or June, I think, if I can even remember correctly, there would be a statewide caucus where delegates from those county conventions would go. But of course, by that time, usually the primary was basically over and then you'd just vote for whoever was going to be the nominee anyway. But that the way that they had previously reported results was there was no sort of popular vote component. It was just a tally of like how many, you know, state delegates was a candidate likely to get at the state convention later based on the current, you know, caucus results from the beginning of the process. And this time that's not, I guess, even happening.
Yeah. So it created kind of an extra layer of separation between the voters and those delegates. So now I guess you're choosing the equivalent of a state delegate. And then at that point, there was a lot of weird rounding happening. And then because you can't send a portion of a delegate, you had to round to the next highest number. And I think they tried to do that as fairly as possible. But in some cases, it was down to like a coin flip or picking a name out of a hat. And I think once you get into those processes, it kind of shakes your faith in the process. There were some videos of some coin tosses that looked pretty dodgy. And while I don't really challenge challenge the result or how much it affects the final result, it just kind of adds that extra seed of doubt. So although it probably doesn't make any significant difference, those one or two coin tosses that look a little weird, it just kind of creates that doubt in the process. And the fact that 100% of the precincts haven't even reported yet about a week later, it just kind of, it's a bad look all the way around for the Democratic Party.
Now, the New York Times and other sources are alleging that the results themselves of the precincts we do have, that there are almost 100 significant inconsistencies that would probably change the results of those caucuses, or at the very least need a second look to make sure that they did have the same final outcome. It seems like the Iowa Democratic Party, the DNC, nobody seems really interested. I guess there's two things going on here. One is people on the ground just being completely stretched thin and beyond their capacity because they didn't think it was going to play out like this, and they weren't expecting to need people to be on call for a full calendar week or more to sort out this mess. But you also just have the potential of people here, at least at the national level, probably not as much in the state party level, trying to put their thumb on the scale one way or the other. It seems like we're just never going to have confidence in what results we did get out of this, really, other than that it seems like Bernie Sanders won a fairly wide margin in the popular vote regardless.
Right. And I think it's encouraging actually that these inconsistencies have seen the light of day, because I think that was what Bernie Sanders was kind of pointing out in 2016, just the fact that it's kind of a black box and you don't really get to see the numbers. So the fact that we're even seeing the numbers this time around is kind of a testament to how Bernie Sanders has kind of changed and influenced the process.
Right. Here. I mean, the official position of the Sanders campaign last time was that they accepted the results of the Iowa caucuses, where they got 49% of the state delegate or state delegate equivalents, whatever you want to call them, and that, you know, that they were down by 4 compared to Hillary Clinton, and this was the closest ever. The current count has them down by 2 to Buttigieg, but again, with not all the results completely in and these, you know, 95 or so inconsistencies reported by sources like the New York Times looking at the count themselves. But as you say, they always maintained unofficially that they had won the popular vote in Iowa last time, and that the only reason this wasn't reflected was because, you know, in some cases they had so many people caucusing at one particular site that it didn't really net them any additional of these state delegates or state delegate equivalents or whatever, and that they would have won a popular vote count, but this has never been released in the history of Iowa before, any sort of popular vote count. The only reason we know this year that there was this problem, you know, is because people can see very clearly where there are number errors in the popular vote reporting itself, in terms of what was being released, because party officials were releasing their own counts and saying, look, these are the results we had in my county. Why is it different from the results that's coming out at the state level? Which again is probably less about intentional interference and more about just making mistakes trying to enter all of this data or whatever, and then just being bad about actually correcting it. It seems like a big win to have the popular vote tallies out this year, and also clearly proves that Sanders won. But by the end of the process, if there is an end to this process, if these inconsistencies are resolved, it is very likely that Sanders will have also won by the state delegate equivalent metric as well, once those things are all smoothed out, if they are ever smoothed out. But again, one of the other things the Sanders campaign did, which I want to talk a little bit about here before we move on to talk about the rest of the nomination contest process for other states, is just the fact that the Sanders campaign, while pushing to get this popular vote count as part of the process, is also essentially saying, hey, you know, we're going to make a conscientious effort to try to win by this other metric as well, and not have that problem of hugely superfluous numbers of caucusers in some sites not really getting us any additional SDEs. And that brought us to what these satellite caucuses. So could you talk about what those were?
Yeah, so I think in an effort to kind of capture more people as well at different times. So the satellite caucuses occurred earlier in the day in locations that were a little bit more accessible, like apartment buildings, so forth. Satellite
Even
caucuses.
Places of work for people.
Right, yeah. The satellite caucuses, I think, were a new development this year. There seems to be kind of a problem interpreting the rules of the caucus as to how many state delegates the satellite caucuses are apportioned. So I'm not entirely sure what the two different interpretations are, but they do change the weight of these satellite caucuses and how many delegates they get assigned. And the difference between the two interpretations is a net 3.8 state delegates, which normally really wouldn't be an issue, but because it is so close between Sanders and Buttigieg, it could tip the contest towards Sanders, because he was the overwhelming winner in these satellite caucuses.
Seems like the other campaigns just didn't even contest them in most cases.
Yeah, just seeing the reports on Twitter, it was usually between one or two candidates at these satellite caucuses and just kind of overwhelmingly going to Sanders. So I'm not entirely sure how the rules got kind of written, so it's hard to interpret, but it's probably something they're going to have to tighten up for the next presidential campaign.
Seemed helpful, though, in terms of getting a lot of various immigrant and refugee communities to be able to participate more, folks who were, you know, work in the night shift at the caucuses and so forth, being able to participate. You know, obviously Iowa, not an enormously diverse state relative to the national population, but I think also people had maybe gone the other way a little bit in downplaying the existence of minorities at all in Iowa, which 10% of the population is non-white. And we saw, you know, various like Latino heavy or African-American heavy or various Asian communities of all different ethnicities, including there was one that was specifically all refugees from Myanmar. Even in that caucus alone, there were about 10 different ethnic groups that were participating. There was a caucus for Bosnian Muslims. And again, as you said, mostly overwhelmingly being won by Bernie Sanders, probably a bunch of the candidates regretting their lack of participation or organization of those. It seems like the whole muddle out of this, ultimately, it's hard to tell what effect that's going to have. It seems like maybe Mayor Pete got a little bit of a boost out of his CIA-style declaration of victory before the votes were counted, of like just seizing the moment, and maybe that'll help him a little bit in New Hampshire. I guess we'll find out in a few days, or the day of when this is going to be airing. And it seems like the person probably hurt the most by it was Elizabeth Warren, because they were trying to play up her third place finish, which to my mind still not that great for her, but I guess their messaging of, oh, we exceeded expectations, has gotten thrown off because of the lack of clarity on these results. Bernie Sanders, some people I think thinking that he was getting really hurt by the way that some of the media was saying that Buttigieg won or whatever. But again, I don't think that's necessarily true either, because he was coming into the Iowa caucuses as basically the front runner at this point, had just overtaken Biden. It seems like all the polling since then, he's now the national front runner. He did clearly win the popular vote. I think plenty of people heard that part of it, at least supporters did. So it seems like that, you know, he's probably not too adversely affected by it. And, you know, it didn't damage him, in, at least, I think, even if it didn't give him a huge boost. The results being so, you know, weird and unclear seems to have helped Biden by obscuring to some degree his fourth place finish, although, again, his numbers are starting to crater. Somehow Amy Klobuchar also getting up and giving a speech very early saying, oh, we did so great here, even though she finished in fifth place just behind Biden, at least in the popular tallies, seems to have maybe given her a little bit of a bump in places like New Hampshire, but I don't think that's really going to go anywhere. But, you know, as I just alluded to a few minutes ago, one of the big problems with these caucuses is their inaccessibility. I mean, we're still talking about only 15 or 16% of the population being participating in this, or the eligible population. What we know, for example, in a state like Idaho that was a caucus last time is that, you know, you, Rachel, got to participate, as you'll talk about, in the Idaho caucuses. But your sister, who's also been on the show many times before, Sarah, did not get to participate because she had a night shift that she had to be working, or at least work in the evening that particular day. So they're not going to be doing a caucus there. Can you talk to us about what they are going to be doing in Idaho and why that change was made? And then talk about, I guess, we can talk about the other changes in other states as well.
We decided, the Idaho Democratic Party decided in 2018 that it would switch from using caucuses to a state-run primary. It is happening March 9th, so it's the week after Super Tuesday, and it's actually also separate from the state race primaries as well, so those will still be happening in May, and then this is just dedicated to the primary. This was a decision made because the 2016 had a huge turnout compared to previous caucuses. It was really poorly run because there was one location per county. And so Ada County has a population of about 500,000 people. So having one location for the caucus for the entire county turned into a logistical nightmare. Thousands of people attended the caucus. It was split into two different locations, just kind of across a walkway from each other. So there's an arena and kind of a convention hall in the same block. And if you wanted to caucus for Bernie, you were sent to an arena, so a sports arena, basically. And if you wanted to caucus for Hillary, you were sent to the convention center across that walkway. So there was no chance for kind of what people tout as being a pro for the caucus process. There was no chance to talk to anybody and try to persuade people on your side. There were just thousands of people. It was a madhouse.
Yeah, imagine trying to motivate an entire arena to change their vote. I mean, that's,
right,
come on.
Exactly. Yeah, I knew it was going to be crazy. So I went to downtown Boise right after work. I think I got in line at about 5:15 or 5:30. Nobody was getting inside the arena for about like 90 minutes. So the process just took hours. And I don't think I even left the arena until about 11 o'clock at night.
Wow.
So it just was an absolute nightmare. The candidates for those delegates for the state convention were just kind of running around trying to get people to fill out a ballot, because I think most people were first time caucus goers and didn't really know about that state delegate race at all, and who you had to pick somebody. And a lot of these people aren't really established names in the Democratic Party. They were just kind of running around being like, hey, I want to be the state delegate, write my name down on a ballot and give it to somebody. So it was very disorganized. It was an absolute nightmare. So this year we are having the Democratic primary, and then we're going to have a county convention throughout the state on April 4th, I believe. So at that point, people get to pick their delegates to go to that state convention and pick the delegates that go to the national convention. So I think this process will be a lot more streamlined. The people that are more familiar with the party are going to choose the delegates. So I think it'll just go a lot more smoothly with this process that we switched to.
Now, Nate, you were actually the person who had flagged for me, someone who does pay relatively close attention to some of this stuff, that a lot of the states had made this change this year. I had not realized that until you brought it up to me after, you know, everyone's reeling from the chaos in Iowa and trying to figure out, well, is it going to be like this in, you know, a lot of the states? And last time there were plenty of states. One of the kind of frustrating talking points is that, oh, you know, the Bernie Sanders campaign really benefited from caucus states last time. So they've been trying to keep these undemocratic and inaccessible caucuses, when in fact they were actually pretty heavily involved in advocating for conversion to primaries in a lot of these states. There's an article from The Economist here. I want to know if you could read for us some of their notes on changes to the calendar and which states are even having caucuses this year.
Yeah, so as we talked about, there's a lot of states that have eliminated them, but now only of the states because there are like caucuses in the territories and such as well, various imperial holdings. So it's Iowa, which that didn't go well, Nevada coming up soon, Wyoming, and North Dakota. Although, Bill, you're noting here that this is not technically a caucus. I guess it's actually a primary in North Dakota.
I didn't note that. Yeah, so I think The Economist was noting it. I don't know what that distinction is.
I mean, maybe.
Is. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about North Dakota. But, yeah, it seems like this is going to be a much more limited part of the process this year. And once we get past Nevada, it's sort of just going to be an afterthought, I feel like, because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a big change, though, because it was, you know, it was 14 states last year. I mean, you had states like, obviously, we talked about Idaho, but also, like, pretty significantly sized states like Washington and Oklahoma and so forth that are still early in the calendar that were caucuses last time, which Bernie Sanders won, and now they're primaries. He's probably still going to win them, but, you know, it's just sort of interesting to reflect on that change that we had these 14 states. We could potentially be seeing a repeat, you know, if they hadn't changed these rules of, oh, let's do Iowa fiasco 14. Times this year, mostly in the month of March, early in the process. But in fact, we're going to see that almost all of them, as you said, have been changed to primaries or some sort of hybrid system or something. Yeah, I guess that's it. Sort of an interesting change. Do you want to talk a little bit about the calendar itself here? It seems like that is something that also people weren't quite aware of. That's been my experience talking to people, is a lot of them not really understanding that you can't just say, oh, let's let the process play out if you don't want to have a contested convention, because with Texas and California going on Super Tuesday, not later in the month or at the end of the process in the case of California, this is going to be even more front-loaded than 2008, which was one of the most front-loaded ones ever held. And that's also why Obama was the nominee, because he came out of Super Tuesday with a significant lead and then a bunch of favorable
right.
states ahead of that.
Well, I feel like there was like a part of the talking point was, Iowa, New Hampshire, the very white, not representative of the country. So I guess the solution to that was just to do all of the primary within the first couple weeks. So by March 17th, just 6 weeks after Iowa, states accounting for 60% of all delegates will have voted. That rises to 90% by May. So, I mean, I don't want to like jinx it or whatever, saying if Bernie does like very well in some of these big states or whatever, but they could be setting up a situation where Bernie is comfortably in the plurality or in the majority of all delegates for like months and months heading into the convention. And then if they try to take it away from him there, you know, that's going to make it even worse. Like, it just doesn't seem like this process was all that well thought out, even beyond all the Iowa disaster and things like that. Obviously, I think California and all these states probably should not have gone at the very end like they did last time, where essentially their votes were meaningless because AP had already declared it for Hillary like the night before. But I don't know if putting it so early is a good idea either. So yeah, just a little, we'll see how it goes. And I think the situation actually could be pretty advantageous for Sanders. But yeah, it seems like it's all trying to jam it in super quickly. And
yeah,
then...
I think that you're right, that basically by having a front-loaded calendar like this, it favors a candidate that has a significant national name recognition and a significant national operation. This year, I think there are only three candidates that have significant national operations, not only spread out nationwide in terms of, you know, the number of volunteers and staff, but also having a significant operation in the early states, which I think that, you know, for the people, the Bloomberg heads out there who think that he's going to do really well or are afraid that he's going to do very well, I think that they are maybe overstating some of that, just because I think the early states really do have an impact. We've got four states ahead of the Super Tuesday, but then if you are someone with a national campaign operation, you're going to do pretty well on Super Tuesday as well, and it's going to be tough if you don't have that in place. In the past, having a more spread out calendar would allow someone who did well in the early states to build up from there using that bounce. No one, as we said, really getting a bounce out of Iowa. Bernie Sanders potentially on track to win New Hampshire. We'll see. I think if he does that, he's going to probably win Nevada from there. I think he's going to do better than expected in South Carolina, and also depending on how the race shakes out, he might even win South Carolina. But even if he doesn't, really, again, this comes down to the three candidates who have national operations in my mind and who's viable there. And as you said, it may benefit Bernie Sanders in the sense that he's got the name recognition, he's got the national operation, and he's surging ahead, as opposed to Biden, who is imploding as a result of his weak performance in Iowa and expected weak performance in the other states, basically saying, oh yeah, I'm going to do pretty badly in the first three states. And the joke being, oh, they're just practice states. Elizabeth Warren also kind of on a down downswing all the way since, you know, October or November. Really seems like she kind of struggled in Iowa, might have even had a worse sort of perception if that Des Moines Register poll showing her in second place had come out instead of just relying on like New York Times polls showing her in fourth place. And then, you know, somebody like Mayor Pete, I don't think is going to probably, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think he's going to go the distance because I don't think he has an operation really further out. But it just seems like, yeah, Elizabeth Warren also is now struggling in a lot of these states to poll above 15%, which is the minimum you need to get any delegates at all. We could see in a state like California, which is a huge number of delegates, we could see Bernie Sanders getting literally all of the delegates if none of the other candidates are above 15%, even though it is a proportional allocation state. You know, he'd be really running away with it. I think he could also end up, you know, winning Texas, but it's a lot of big states too on Super Tuesday. It's not just like, oh, it's a bunch of small states and then two big ones. Like a lot of them are pretty significantly sized number of delegates and so forth. As Nate said, we're looking at, you know, 60% of delegates by March 17th, but it's also 30% on Super Tuesday itself. The other big change to talk about here before we close out is just the change to the superdelegates and the impact that that has, if you want to go through that very briefly, Nate.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about this, of course, and there's been some recent chatter about this, including the typical sorts of mental wokeness gymnastics that we'll get to. But yeah, so they, I mean, there was the whole Unity Commission that was put through right after the 2016 election, where you had Bernie and Tom Perez go on the road, sort of a very awkward, sort of odd couple type. And then there were times where people were totally ignoring Tom Perez at some of these stops. Like, it's just been not a great DNC chairmanship for him. There are 16% of the total delegates. Some 771 delegates are, I guess, technically unpledged or superdelegates, and before they could vote on the first ballot, but now, of course, they are forced to only vote on the second ballot. So unless there is an outcome that's already determined, then they could potentially get involved. So this is why, you know, you're sort of wondering, in the event of a contested convention, are these the guys that are going to try to tip it over the scales for maybe Pete, or are they going to go for Bloomberg, or what's going to happen if there's no first ballot winner? So,
and that's why it is important, I think, to get a nominee with a majority of pledged delegates before it gets to that process so that they can't tip the balance.
Right. Yeah. But of course, you know, these super delegates have been defended as, oh, these are Black and Latino elected officials. It's actually racist to get rid of these super delegates, you know, just sort of like working backwards from the preferred outcome and see if we can call people racist for, you know, not wanting party elites to decide the nominee.
Yeah. And sorry, they're voters. Not. If they swoop in to pick somebody as a consensus unity candidate or some garbage, it's not going to be Julian Castro and Deval Patrick that get the pick. Sorry.
And then, of course, I mean, this is tangentially related, but, you know, someone like Julian Castro might still be in the race if the DNC hadn't used its debate qualifications shenanigans to exclude him and then bring Bloomberg back in so Bloomberg can get the media attention. I mean, it's ridiculous. The DNC, you know, I think Tom Perez said today that he won't resign. You know, he believes he's doing a great job. I mean, you could have seen this coming going all the way back to the DNC chair race after the 2016 election and how this was so obvious, like a plant for Obama and sort of the establishment there. But,
and I know, you know, a lot of people are feeling kind of frustrated by how the Democratic Party handled things with the Iowa debacle, and certainly it was not well handled. But I don't think that there's necessarily some sort of really well-established or competent conspiracy happening here. I mean, there might even be people who are trying to put their thumb on the scale, but I just don't. I think the party itself, the institutions, the leadership is so weak at this point that I don't think they're going to be capable of stopping someone like Sanders. I mean, again, their only hope is to get it to a contested convention, and even that is starting to look a lot less likely now than it had a few weeks ago. You know, remains to be seen again what happens over the next few weeks, but I think that, you know, it's the party's ability to stop this from happening is going to be significantly diminished than people might have expected. So I think there's still a lot of reason to keep the hope out there and keep hitting those doors and actually getting out there and talking to voters rather than just throwing up your hands and seeing what happens. Nate, thanks for being on the show this week.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.
Rachel, thank you so much for doing all the research into these changes and talking about what happened in Idaho last time.
You're welcome. It's always a pleasure.